A1. Number 8, B.
And so you begin to see that we should not fall into that mistake of always accusing ourselves for everything that goes wrong. Mostly, it isn't our individual belief. Mostly, it's against our individual belief. But because the majority of the people have a collective belief, it can, it mustn't, but it can affect us. We'll see later on what we can do about it. For the present moment, I just want to depict, you see, that we, what moral consciousness is. Now, next to these individual beliefs, then to collective beliefs, we come to a third classification, to universal beliefs. We must also see that we are subject, if we don't know better, that we are subject to universal beliefs. Universal beliefs are those beliefs which seem to operate not only, say, with men or at a certain age of manhood, but which befalls man and the whole nature since the beginning of the world. These are the universal beliefs. Universal beliefs are those beliefs which existed long before man was created. Men, mortals, were created. For instance, such under the universal beliefs we can classify disease. There were diseases before a mortal existed. Plants, animals, fishes, birth and so on have disease just as well. Death is a universal belief. Death existed long before man existed. Plants were dying, fishes were dying, and so on. Death is a universal belief. Just by the way, have we ever asked somebody who we say has died if he has really died? It's just a belief that there is death. We have no proof from those who pass on, so to say, that they are dead. We have only one big proof that it is a lie, namely that Jesus came and just wanted to prove this fact, that one can't die. We really are very, very inconsistent in our reasoning. No one has said ever that he is dead. Our proof that he is dead. We only have one proof, and that is Jesus' proof, and he proved that man cannot be dead. So death is really a universal belief, which is a belief and not a fact. There is no such a thing in the whole universe as death. A universal belief is accident. Accidents have always happened before. Before man came down from the trees and separated himself from the monkeys, there were accidents. And there were always catastrophes. There were always tornadoes, earthquakes, floods, storms, etc., long before mortals were walking around. There is the universal belief in heredity, which existed long before mortals existed. The belief of poison, the belief of astrology, of cosmic influences, the age belief, all that, those beliefs are universal beliefs. And they make up a very great proportion of our consciousness. So, let us see that if we ever will handle evil, will have handle disease, that it is not enough to try to find a fault in one's own consciousness, but rather more to see that mortal consciousness, which is built up of individual beliefs, collective beliefs, and universal beliefs, must be handled and must be put right. Also, we could make another classification and see that we have to deal with conscious as well as unconscious beliefs. Up to recently, people were apt only to think about conscious error, about conscious beliefs. They would say, well, I have never been conscious of this and this error, and yet it did befall me. But they would never think of the unconscious consciousness. But as psychology tries to point out today too, we must be aware that most that is going on in our life is the effect not of conscious belief, but of the unconscious. Psychologists say that that which we consciously know about ourselves as a mortal is only about 10% of all that what mortal mind is telling about us. The other 90% is unconscious mortal mentality, which includes all the carnal beliefs, really, that go back, say, over the last 3, 4, 5 thousand years. This is very necessary to know in the practice, because if we have a case which we have to heal, it's no good to try to discuss endlessly with the patient where he may have gone wrong, and to put him through the third degree and ask him all sorts of questions. Have you been behaving like this? Have you been thinking like this or like that? In order to find out where the fault is. This is just asking about those 10% of which the patient may be conscious. But all the other 90% he is not conscious. And usually because he is not conscious of it, he is sick. And so we better go and use another method of uncovering disease and the cause of disease by going to the divine mind and have a good conversation with the divine mind instead of with the mortal mind of a patient. Mortal mind will never tell us the truth anyway. We'll come back to this point when we are considering the practice of Christian Science. For this juncture, let us just see, you see, that when we have to deal with mortal consciousness, that we have to deal first with the individual beliefs, with collective beliefs, with universal beliefs. That within those big range of beliefs, we also have to deal with the conscious belief about these three categories and with the unconscious belief about these three categories. So you begin to realize that this mortal consciousness is a bit bigger than what we were thinking of. I feel myself as if I tried to paint the devil on the wall, bigger and bigger and darker and darker. Well, I have to do it at this juncture, and later on I will wipe it out again. But before one can wipe it out again, one must realize what is our enemy, really. That our enemy is not a form of disease, but is mortal consciousness. And in order to know what mortal consciousness is, we have to analyze it and see it in all its claims. All right. I go to a fourth point, which is really a wonderful point. A point which you must understand. You just can't afford it not to understand. Namely this, that we have to see that mortal mind or mortal consciousness and all its beliefs that it contains is impersonal. That it doesn't belong to a person. You know what I mean with this? If you don't know, I like to tell you. You see, God has not created mortal consciousness. God created the divine consciousness. And because man is the image and likeness of God, man has not created mortal consciousness, how do you say that in English? Has neither created, you see, mortal consciousness. If God has not created mortal consciousness, man, the image and likeness of God, could neither have created mortal consciousness. That's not grammar, is it? That's not good grammar. Well, just sometimes, you see, a grammar lets me down. But the point is that you know what I mean. Thank you very much. Well, the main thing is that we realize that man has not created mortal consciousness. That mortal consciousness is not man's doing, not man's creation. And as a matter of fact, as we have analyzed mortal consciousness, we have seen that most of the beliefs have existed long before mortals existed. That floods, earthquakes, sickness, jealousy, hate, revenge, killing, destruction, all these things have existed long before even mortals existed. Mrs. Eddy defines it like this. It is in retrospection. It is a passage on page 67 which you should, I think, ponder over and over and over. She says, sin existed as a false claim before the human concept of sin was formed. So the human mind has not created sin. Man has not created sin. It existed long before the human concept of sin was formed. Hence, one's concept of error is not the whole of error. This again we have seen. That the individual concept of error, the conscious concept of error, is by far not the whole of error. She says, the human thought does not constitute sin. Think of it, that the human thought does not constitute sin. That the human thought has not pictured out, made out what sin is. But vice versa, Mrs. Eddy says, sin constitutes the human or physical concept. And later on, further down on the page, she says, the sinner created neither himself nor sin. But sin created the sinner. Sin created the sinner. Well, if you read Romans, you will see how Paul would point that out over and over and over, that it is sin that created the sinner, and not that the sinner can sin. That's just not possible. So we could say that sin really sins the sinner. Well, this has a wonderful practical consequence, and I wish Christians would see this point, because it's very seldom that you meet the Christian scientist who really sees this point. It's a pity, really, to see how Christian scientists are moralists instead of scientists and metaphysicians, and that they are the first one to make sin personal and to feel that if somebody does something wrong, he's really no good. This is against the Bible and the Christian Science textbook. Against the Bible. Just let me see how the Bible shows that sin is impersonal, that mortal consciousness is impersonal. As a matter of fact, this is the great first question which had to be solved in the Bible right at the beginning with Adam and Eve. I always feel that Eve doesn't find the true place in our consciousness and in theology. Eve was the first wonderful woman that existed in the Bible. She was the first, she had the first saving concept among mortals. Why? You know how the story runs, how God said to Adam, "Hast thou eaten of the tree, whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat?" And Adam did what mortals usually do, they blame somebody else for evil. They blame somebody else, and afterwards they blame God for it. And that's what Adam has done. He really is the bad boy. He said, "The woman whom thou, God, gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." He said, the woman is to be blamed, not me. The woman is to be blamed. He made evil personal. And not only that, he said, "The woman which thou gavest me." He blamed also God. He said, "You are really to blame. If you, God, wouldn't have given that Eve to me, well, I would be all right." So that's what we usually do. We first blame God, first blame a person and say, "You have sinned. You are the naughty girl or the naughty boy." Making sin personal. And then afterwards we blame God and say, "How could God let something like this happen? Why did God allow such a thing to happen at all? Didn't that person have more understanding of God?" Well, Eve, who was questioned afterwards with the same question, gave a different question. She didn't blame anybody or God. She didn't say, "Well, I couldn't do anything else because I am, after all, your God's creation." No, she said, "The serpent beguiled me." The serpent is a symbol in the Bible for animal magnetism, for impersonal evil. And she could see that evil, sin, is impersonal, the serpent, and said, "That is the cause of every evil." You see, if we begin to realize that really sin sins the sinner, that the serpent sins the Eve and the Adam, then also we make another practical conclusion, namely, that man will never be penalized for sin, and that man should never be penalized for sin, and that God never penalizes man for being sinned, if I may say so. You see, when Lazarus died and Jesus was asked about Lazarus, Jesus would say, when they came, you see, and said, "Behold, he whom thou lovest is sick." Then Jesus said, "This sickness is not unto death." The sickness is not unto death. You cannot be penalized for sin or sickness. "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby." So if we meet any situation where, humanly seen, somebody has sinned, has fallen into temptation, has got sick, has fallen, or anything like that, we should see that that person deserves no penalty, but that that person, for having been put into that situation, should have an occasion to glorify God and to make a great step forward, that it should be for the advancement of the spiritual idea and not for the condemnation of a person. This is just not Christian. It's just not metaphysical. Man is the idea of God, and man has the right to be free from sin and to be glorified. That's why Jesus always said, don't judge a man. Always judge mortal minds. He said, judge not, that ye be not judged. If only we could put that into practice, that we are not going to judge people for what they are, for what they do, but that all judgment is pronounced on mortal mind. Mrs. Eddy says, it is error even to murmur or to be angry over sin. So let us see that sin destroys itself. I think we should never do anything humanly in order to uncover or to destroy evil in somebody or a situation. What we humanly can do is not to be human, but to be metaphysical about it, and to have the consciousness of God, which destroys error in its own way. Mrs. Eddy says, let truth uncover and destroy error in God's own way, and let human justice pattern the divine. So we should see, really, that truth is strong enough and mighty enough to deal with error. We should really see that animal magnetism, the serpent, has really one great purpose, namely to deceive, if possible, even the very elect. Animal magnetism has no interest to handle a mediocre mentality. Animal magnetism has only an interest to handle somebody who is spiritually minded and who has devoted his life and his heart to God. But let's see that evil is always animal magnetism and not a person. If only Christian Scientists could be true to Mrs. Eddy's statement where she says that evil is neither place, person, place, nor thing. It's at the beginning of spiritualism. That evil is neither person, place, nor thing. And it's very seldom that one does meet a Christian Scientist who takes this statement as it is. You see, only then have we real love, when we can see every evil and everything, every sin, as animal magnetism. And we certainly do a greater sin if we make sin personal. You know the story of Noah. He had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And it is said of Noah that he planted a vineyard and he drank of the wine, and he was drunken. And he was uncovered within his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. He just made sin real. And he just couldn't wait until he could tell that to everybody. And Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it up on both their shoulders and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. See, they were metaphysicians. They didn't make evil personal. And what is the result of it? The result of it is that Noah blessed those two sons, Shem and Japheth, whereas he cursed Canaan and said, a servant of servant shall ye be unto his brethren. See, even right at the beginning of the Bible, we see this fact that if we make evil personal, that it falls back on us. That it is even a greater sin to make evil personal than to sin that sin. And that's why Jesus would say, you see, to the Pharisees, he would say, well, publicans and harlots go into the kingdom of God before you. he could see that that state of consciousness which were familiar to the Pharisees, namely that self-justification of saying, well, I am good and the other one is just rotten. I am good and that harlot really did something bad and is just as bad as she can be. He said, to that state of consciousness, you can't go into heaven. The publicans and harlots will go in first. And that's so. In our life, we see that over and over and over and over again. And so, let's see, you see, that what this point four tells us, namely, that sin is impersonal. And that we have to take moral consciousness as something which is impersonal. All right, here we stop.